at GBQ, we're always counting. Now we're making your time count with this episode of Empower Hour. Start the clock.
I'm Doug Davidson, and our guest today is Lawrence Jones, president of risk management firm Riskversity. Welcome, Lawrence.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
When I Google Lawrence Jones, I find out you're everywhere. Active in the community, you founded your own business. I guess I should say active in a lot of communities. We met talking about cybersecurity down in GBQ's Cincinnati office, and I think we'll start with business. But I think as we flow through this, there's a lot of interesting nooks and crannies you've gotten yourself into, and we'll talk about some of those. So tell me about Riskversity.
Yes, Riskversity, as you mentioned, is a risk management consulting firm. We focus on what we call pure risk management as a fractional chief risk officer. We also have an employment risk practice. And as well, we have a cyber risk focus because cyber risk is on everybody's radar. So it's important to have that as well when you're a risk management consulting firm.
So we had met talking about the cyber risk, but there's some other areas. The employment risk is a fairly interesting thing that you do. GBQ does risk management, you do risk management, but there's some nuances, some differences. That workforce piece is particularly different. You know, talk about that a little bit?
Yes, absolutely. So if you think about the landscape of risk, you think about the insurance space, it's your property is a high risk area. Your people is a high risk area. And as we mentioned, cyber is a high risk area. So again, looking at those kind of three components and having employment risk, we focus on helping our clients identify, embrace, or transfer risk. And so from an employment practices standpoint or workforce standpoint, that is, what are you doing from a talent attraction or retention standpoint? That is a risk to your business. You don't have enough people or enough qualified people to execute on the skill sets for your client base or your production needs. That's a risk for your business. We also see that in that space that there was a Me Too movement. So that was something that was a risk for a lot of organizations. And now, since last summer's social unrest, diversity, equity, and inclusion is now raised to the top of that level. So we have what we call JEDI, which is justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion, to focus on helping companies along their journey from a DE&I perspective. It doesn't matter where they are on that journey, but we can help them quantify what they're trying to do, help them identify and assess where they are, at a baseline, help them get to where they want to be.
Well, and that was one of the topics we were going to talk about later, but I think it's a top topic in terms of some of the things that we're dealing with in the business. So we'll just roll with it. Last year you alluded to some things that happened, Me Too and some of the social unrest, and then not to mention ice storms and a bombing in Nashville that took out the telecommunications. And then if we don't mention the pandemic, people are going to say they're not talking about anything that's risk related. It's been a tough 12, 15 months for a business. It's changed the way we work. It's changed where we work, how we work. IT was, I think, kind of underappreciated in terms of what IT organizations did for their firms, but we're short in the labor supply. And to me, it's a math problem. We don't have enough people. How do we step out and encourage people that wouldn't normally traditionally be attracted to IT? And I know you and I had conversations about that. And then
absolutely,
if you attract that non-traditional IT population into your organization, how do you build a culture that lets them feel included? And I understand that's some of what you guys work with.
Absolutely. And I think you hit it right on the head, is that in the IT space, there is a shortage of talent, right? And so when you can't turn out the traditional talent, how do you look at other ways to create opportunities for folks who may be non-traditional, right? And what is that characteristic of someone that could be successful in this industry? I think people, much like the insurance industry, have a lens that you have to look like this, have this type of personality to be in IT. And that's not exactly true, right? There's so many spaces under the IT umbrella that, if you were in finance before or marketing before or engineer, there's probably a lane somewhere in IT and or cybersecurity that you could fit and add value and start to build a career, out of that. And so I think where our conversations were going is, how do we diversify that pool of talent? The world is changing. The United States is changing. How do you create more opportunity for folks who historically have not been drawn to the industry, either because they didn't feel like they could be comfortable in that space by hiring on somewhere that folks that don't look like them, or, you know, just that the industry as they perceive it isn't really truly what it is. So that education factor and getting, you know, down to high schools or just that, you know, change of career opportunity. How do we do that and do that in a way that's meaningful to people and also meaningful to the industry at large, right? It's not just you and I, but for the greater good, if you will.
Yeah, we have a joke here we talk about sometime that IT is like we do sports. It's not just one thing. So if there's sports with balls and there's sports with bats and there's balls you kick and there's balls you hit and there's some sports that don't have any balls at all, there's a sport for just about anybody. And that's true really in the IT realm. My son's a developer. I've been a cyber risk consultant. I did development years ago, but nothing like what he's doing. And all these things in between, help desk technicians and business analysts and, you know, people that are working with these new technologies and they're changing things. There is a place for everybody. But it's my sense is it's not as much a mid-market, hey, learn tech, as it is we get to the younger people and give them an understanding of what the choice is, what opportunities there are. That some of that's where we're failing in the math problem. Does that ring true for you?
Yeah, I think you can say that, you know, somewhere in that 60 to 75% range would be that younger population, right? Turning them onto the industry before they go down one path. But I think you could, you know, you could really look at a different non-traditional, someone who is mid-career level, has business experience, right? Because a lot of times, you know, from an IT perspective, it's business problems, right? And so if you are what we call pure IT and don't necessarily understand all aspects of business and process, you could then hit a wall or a ceiling of your development in that business aspect. So if you can take someone who's had management experience, finance experience, operations experience, and bring them into the field in a, you know, certification type of space from IT or cybersecurity, can I get their feet wet? You can then leverage that foundation of business operation execution and then put that on top, you know, of an IT or cybersecurity and have those things kind of grow together, you know, over time.
Well, and you think about somebody that's been in a non-IT role that's frustrated because things don't move fast enough. They don't see that they could skip steps, that they just have the ability to change something, and that change really could come from them learning IT and coming back to that same problem and solving it. The no code and the low code environment that Microsoft 365, for instance, is producing really puts that business skill at a higher level than the deep dive developer. We don't need those deep dive development roles today with some of the tools that are out there, but we need the people to be attracted to come in and learn how to use that tech to really make that difference.
Absolutely.
So we've talked about letting people learn or giving people an opportunity, younger people an opportunity to understand what a career entails and, you know, what advantages there might be and what it might really be like when they're younger. And that's what attracts people. What about you? You started at one of the big four firms as a CPA or started as staff and got your CPA while you're there, I imagine, and then moved to a regional firm, much like GBQ. And then you took the plunge and started your own business. What started you off thinking about becoming an accountant, and what age were you when that happened?
Going to the University of Cincinnati, you know, co-op is a huge piece of the learning college career there. And so having a finance, you know, background, well, initially I started out in arts and sciences. I wanted to be a pharmacist, but quickly learned that was not my cup of tea. So went over to the Lender College of Business to then focus on finance first. And my first internship at Fifth Third Bank is where one of the managers in the department said, if you really want to go far in this space, you know, finance is great, but you can really broaden your horizons if you have an accounting, you know, accounting base. So I took that nugget of information and ran back to school and changed my classes and then created a double major of finance and accounting so that I had that base and really can open up the doors to go in either direction. And through that process and additional internships, decided to go work at Ernst & Young to then create my accounting platform, if you will.
And then from there to Big Four and the regional and then the crazy plunge of entrepreneurship.
Entrepreneurship.
Tell me about that. That was what, 2014?
Yeah, 2014 is when I made the decision to not be directly compensated by someone else. And I had to plan for, you know, being an accountant and being risk averse to some degree. I planned for that, right, to give me enough runway to try to, you know, fail enough times to start to be successful at something. Oftentimes, you know, entrepreneurs have a great idea, but they don't have enough runway to get them to all the iterations of, you know, tweaking what their deliverable, their product, to get to a point where they can start to make some money to be sustainable, right? And so, you know, having that accounting at heart and of training, I really had that foundation really planned for that, from the start, and then to leverage my relationship. So I really felt strong that if I went out on my own to create something, that the relationships that I had in the, in the city and around the state and across the country, that, I realized that people don't always buy what you're selling, they're buying you. Right. So they trust me. They trust, my character. You know, I'm going to show up and deliver on whatever platform it is. If I go sell cars, I have people who would come buy a car from me. If they saw me selling computers, yesterday, they come buy a car from me today because they trust me. They know that I'm going to do what's right, by them, put them first, and going to deliver, what I can deliver as a top notch, a quality, product. And so I think having that as a baseline gave comfort to just kind of go out there and risk it all, if you will. And it's been a bumpy ride. We've had some, economic things and, industry things that create, some of those waves, if you will. But we had a plan and we stuck with it. We've tinkered with it a bit. And we can say that, I'm not as successful as I want to be, but I can claim that we are successful. We made it past our 5-year mark, which is one of those, critical factors. If you can make it past 5 years, you've done something, right? And so now we're on to that next five-year run.
Yeah, we went 15 before I joined GBQ, and that first plunge is, regardless of how your risk tolerance is a big step, because suddenly, in 2 weeks, that check isn't coming, benefits aren't there, and you're married and have kids, and you've got a lot of other responsibilities as a dad and a husband, and it becomes a big deal.
Absolutely.
But creativity and being able to solve problems that you see in the way you see fit, I think probably really drives you, from what I've come to learn and know about Lawrence Jones.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you picked up on that, Doug. One of my mentors, who, what I wouldn't call it an official mentor, but Tony Yates, who's the basketball coach at the University of Cincinnati, you may recognize that name. When I joined the Alumni Association for UC, when I joined the board, he kind of took me under his wing, and we kind of had those offline counseling sessions, if you will. And what he told me, this might have been maybe in 2004, somewhere in that ballpark, I believe, he said, you need to be a professional problem solver. If you can be identified as a professional problem solver, you will be fine. And that means that somebody will pay you to solve their problems, no matter what it is. I don't care if you are the expert in that, or you just have the resources to point to the people who can solve those problems. If you can be that, you will be successful. So I don't care if you're the quarterback of the football team, you're on a baseball team, it's in your business, if it's in life, if you can solve those problems and be the go-to person, you will be fine. And so I carry that nugget with me. Anytime I mentor someone or have a relationship, I always tell them, hey, this is a great nugget for me. Be a professional problem solver in any way, shape, or form. As you can identify that, that will help you go far.
So I see two things that I know about you, and then you can fill in the blanks. I think your toolbox then as that professional problem solver is, you're good at asking questions, and you got to find the problem before you can solve it. And you're great at networking because oddly enough, I looked at your LinkedIn, and people I know from Miami University. I don't like the UC name coming up here as much as it does. But anyway, but it's interesting that out of the common people that we know in LinkedIn, I think there's three of them from my days in Miami of Ohio. So these networks today are real interesting, but those are two very obvious Lawrence Jones tools in the toolbox, the knowing the right question and networking. What else have you done to become that professional problem solver?
No, I think, down that networking piece, there's networking to know people, right? And there's networking for people to know you. But then there's networking to understand resources and skill sets, right? So I look at it from all those facets, right? Some folks you just want to know to be around them to enjoy their company, right? You could be great friends, but you will never do business together. And it's just going to be that way. And other times you're meeting folks where you have enough in common to create a professional relationship, and you understand that what their skill set is, or who their client skill sets, what their clients may need, that you could be a resource for that. Or other part of that is knowing who other folks are and what they can do, so that when one of your connections has an issue, a problem, that whether I'm solving it directly or I can point to someone in my network who can solve their problem, I'm still defined as a problem solver. So I have clients today that will call me and say, hey, Lawrence, I'm sure you know somebody. I need a new refrigerator. I need a new washer and dryer. I need somebody that needs to, you know, I need to come out and do my yard work. Do you know anybody? Well, the answer is yes. I'm going to send people to you that I vetted, that I know that they've done great work. They've done work for my clients or my friends or my family. I'm going to vouch for them and put quality people, you know, in front of you. And you'd be surprised at how often someone from a business professional relationship will call and ask a random, you know, personal type of, you know, recommendation or a need. And I take value that they trust me enough to ask me those kind of questions or ask for my, you know, advice on some random non-business thing.
So even if it's something you're not good at, like the last thing in the world is Lawrence Jones is going to come and do the carpentry in my house, but you might know somebody, and I know if you know them that they're trusted, or at least you have that perspective on them, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. I did have that just 3 weeks ago. Somebody posted on Facebook, hey, I need someone to come do my hardwood floors. I'm like, I've got a guy. Made the connection. And guess what? He's now doing those hardwood floors and now some other work because I made that connection.
Well, that's cool. That's a great attitude to have. I see some of that in your nonprofit work too. I started to make a list and I was going to read what would probably have been for listeners a pretty boring with Talbert House and UC. So you're really involved in understanding the value that networking plays in your business. But I think it's also your personal investment in the community or communities you're in, mostly Cincy-based, but I think you get your way up here to Columbus some. Talk about your nonprofit work. I know it's an extension of your work, but it's also an extension of you as an individual.
Absolutely. And so this kind of really takes it back to my upbringing and you know, my grandmother, my mom's side, you know, she was, you know, an advocate for giving back, you know, to the community, you know, helping out, you know, she did hers mostly, you know, through church, coming from Alabama, which is why I like to say Roll Tide, just that upbringing of being in the church and being in the community and giving back in a variety of ways. She really brought that, you know, to the family, you know, here in Cincinnati. And really be able to take that approach to not only, you know, to give money, but to give your time, but also your talent, right? So some of these organizations that I, you know, that I'm on the board for, they have needs that are insurance or risk management or accounting, and I can help point and guide them in a variety of different ways. For me, it's really about finding that passion that correlates with what is important to me, to be connected to an organization who's doing those same things, and then be able to bring my three T's, time, talent, and treasure to the party, if you will, to help that organization, you know, go forward. And yes, we do serve nonprofit organizations from a business perspective, but more importantly to your point is that I enjoy giving back and helping those organizations make the biggest impact in the community that they can. So I do a lot, you know, with education from a higher ed perspective, also give back, you know, through K-12. I'm in some of the healthcare spaces, social services spaces, the arts community, you name it, I'm tapping it. And what I really realize is there's some interconnectivity between all of them, right? And if you can really help draw some of the lines between the interactions and the needs, you can really help these organizations go, you know, further, faster. That's kind of my belief. And also kind of take approach that, you know, at, you know, my ripe career, you know, age, I would say that, you know, going to a whole bunch of networking events and taking that time away from family just doesn't give me the same value as if I can take, you know, time at a breakfast time or lunchtime and sit on the board, still meet people as I would at a networking event, but meet people in a valuable way where you're working together to solve a problem for the community.
Well, and that's practical these days because how many of those networking events are gone, or we try to do them.
Exactly.
And you know, I'm sitting here drinking my coffee instead of the venue's coffee. Or at the end of the day, and I'm drinking my beer instead of the venue's beer, and those types of things just fall flat. But you're right, rolling your sleeves up and getting engaged with people and working, regardless of whether it's online or in person, is a great way to connect. And then looking at your online profile, it seems like you really make a difference in a lot of those things that you do. So of the nonprofit work that you do, what stands out as being most personally valuable to you? I'm going to cause you trouble if you got to pick a winner. So. But you did say Roll Tide, so I got to pay you back somehow.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I expect nothing less from you during this session. You know, if I had to really pick what's most near and dear to my heart and one that I spend the most time with, and you won't like me saying this either, University of Cincinnati, right? I mean, I think going to school there and being an urban institution provided me, you know, really created the baseline, the foundation for who I am today. if I didn't go to UC and make those relationships and be a part of the co-op program, I can't say that I would be doing what I'm doing today the way that I'm doing it. And then by, you know, going to school, being raised in Cincinnati, going to school in Cincinnati, and then having the, you know, business, you know, headquartered in Cincinnati, not all folks have the ability or been able to do that. Now, if you're from Cincinnati, you tend to stay there. So it's not uncommon or unheard of. A lot of folks tend to try to leave for college and then come back at some point. But, you know, being local allows me to really roll my sleeves up and get into the classroom on a regular basis. Well, you know, pre-COVID, I would, you know, be on campus two or three times a month, speaking to a variety of, you know, classes. As we talked about, how do you help bring awareness to certain industries? And so I would go talk to a finance class and talk about, you know, taking some classes in accounting, how that could be beneficial. And now I'm talking to those same classes, accounting and finance. You know, you might want to look at, you know, some IT related stuff, some cybersecurity stuff, some information systems, insurance or risk management, because all of those things are going to be a part of your career at some level. But the experience and knowledge of what those careers, you know, have to offer, you may decide to pivot and go into a different direction. I will tell you, Doug, that I'm also on some professional boards, and we kind of did a quick around the room survey. The majority of the folks who are in their risk management, at least on the boards I belong to or associations, about 40% of them came from the accounting space. Like, their background was in accounting. They somehow ended up in the risk management space, because if you think about it, as an accountant, you really are trying to manage mainly financial risk, but you do tap into some of the operational stuff when it strongly impacts, you know, the financial wherewithal of an organization.
I've seen that. It was, you know, I'm a late career changer into the public accounting space. I'm not a CPA. When GBQ acquired the firm, I had been in the tech world for most of my professional career. And coming in, there's a different culture within the accounting world as compared to the tech world. We have some clients that are IT managers, IT professionals, CIOs, that do a tremendous job of managing IT risk and cyber risk. It's interesting, though, when the CFO or an accounting professional gets involved in that, because it broadens out, and firms are, what we see, dealing with digital risks that go beyond cyber today. We have privacy. We have this employment risk that you mentioned earlier. We have supply chain, and really, almost, if you think about it, a distribution chain disruption here over the last year. People can't get things they need to make their product, and the customers moved. You know, the
right.
Come down here in the Arena District, there's a lot of restaurants that used to be, you know, 20-minute wait at lunch, and you can get right in because the consumer moved. Having that financial analysis brought in along with the technology analysis is very valuable. And we do work with a lot of accounting professionals at their clients that are managing risk, and not just the cyber risk that is most of our work. As you know, firms are really trying to get their arms around this cyber liability and insurance in general. And that really requires some of that discipline that you accountants learn. And I think you learn it equally as well at UC or Miami. I will front you out as the guy that wore Roll Tide gear the day of and the day after the national championship game. But that just speaks to both, A, Lawrence is a fun guy and he's competitive, and we're going to throw our school colors back and forth at each other. So anyway, but
absolutely,
you know, that accounting discipline, I think, does add a lot of value when somebody is looking at risk. That speaks to the need for some financial discipline in some of this. So you're helping boards with some of that. You help clients with some of that. I know you've talked to some of our clients about cyber liability insurance. What are you seeing as far as the insurance space? Is that I know it's been really over this last 15 months pressed pretty hard. You know, cyber attacks are incredibly elevated. The bad guys were taking advantage of what was going on. But then some of the weather issues have really pushed the insurance market. How do you advise a client when they're taking a look at their insurance from that accounting discipline and help them understand what risks they need to take? And that's a cyber question or a broader question across their whole portfolio. Tell me how you will.
Yeah, I think the answer is, you know, pretty much, you know, the same. It's, you know, it's depending on who's asking the question or trying to look at it, right? So you're talking to the CFO, they're looking at their budget, they're trying to figure out how do they get that insurance number down, right? That's kind of their focus. And you get more of that when they don't have a pulse, number one, on the industry, but also of managing risk in their organization, right? So, you know, not all risk is bad risk, right? And a lot of risk is for growth, right? You wouldn't have, you know, a company like Apple today or GBQ or Riskversity for that matter, if someone didn't take a risk on creating that organization and sacrificing something to build what it is, you know, today, right? And so oftentimes, you know, when we're talking to CFO who's focus is to procure insurance, but they're procuring insurance because you have to, right? Not really from truly understanding all the risk factors of the organization. So what we're telling our clients is, yes, we all want to pay less, you know, for insurance, but the more important part is that you want to pay less for what you actually need. Let's not just be paying less for paying less sake. Let's pay less for what you actually need. So if you have a $15 million exposure, you want to insure for that $15 million exposure, but you want to pay the least amount as possible for that $15 million, you know, coverage limit. And how do you do that? That's by, you know, risk management. What are you doing in your process to mitigate those risks? You can communicate that to the underwriters that, yes, we have a pulse on this. We have an eye on this. So if we're buying this $15 million coverage, we shouldn't be paying the same, you know, the same rate as someone who's doing nothing. How do you communicate that to the underwriters, right? So that's really our focus, is really to help our clients identify what their risks are, right? And then lean into that and embrace it or transfer the risk, which that's the buying insurance part, right? So you don't always have to buy the limit that you need. You can self-insure to a portion of that. You know, we feel comfortable with this risk and it's not going to happen. So we're going to buy $15 million. But we're going to have a retention level of $1 million because we're that confident that we're not going to have a catastrophic, you know, issue down this path. We have our eye on the ball, if you will. So really helping our clients understand how risk management and insurance work together. That can be from a property perspective. That can be from a workforce perspective. That can be for a cyber perspective. That could be from a reputational risk perspective. All of those things, it's still that same process to identify and quantify what the exposure is. And then how do you deal with that? If that's self-insuring it and embracing that risk, or are you going to transfer that risk and buy some level of insurance?
Well, I think you mean knowingly self-insure it, right? Because
knowingly self-insure, yes, absolutely.
Speaking just to the cyber side, we see a lot of clients that are knowingly self-insured because they think about the network in the traditional premises-based network. Everything that's valuable to me is behind the firewall. They buy security, they buy insurance, they apply controls based on that environment. And then what we've seen in the last 12 months have accelerated this, is that many of our valuables are outside of the walls. They're in cloud systems, Microsoft 365, line of business systems that are moving to the cloud, because my premises-based ERP didn't perform when I was sitting at home. So I pushed that out to the cloud. I go with a lot of apps on my phone to run not critical business processes, but marketing and recruiting and other items. Some of those are freemiums. They don't go through a purchasing process.
Right.
And so suddenly all this information that I'm obligated to steward, to take care of, is outside of the boundaries I control and outside of my control. And I can transfer risk. I can transfer it in a variety of ways, but I can't transfer the obligation. And so what we right. see is where people don't realize, or organizations don't realize, they've seemingly transferred the obligation. They're unknowingly self-insured because all their valuable data that the government says or their contracts say they need to protect is outside of their control. And I'm sure you're seeing a lot
right.
of that.
100%. And to your point, I think COVID really heightened that, because it wasn't, and when folks move to the cloud, there's some evaluation process and planning for doing such things. But when COVID came, there were some companies that already kind of had some of that stuff in process and they just accelerated it. You know, there was another 30% of, you know, businesses in the U.S. that were not prepared to have employees work from home, whether that was as simple as, you know, having laptops versus desktops so that folks can work from home. So they're out at Best Buy and Costco, wherever they could go, they're trying to buy a hardware device that meets none of the requirements that they would technically have from a, you know, from a device that connects to their network. They need something, because something was better than nothing, to get people to be able to work, you know, work from home. And so when you used to have maybe, you know, one to call it 10 networks that you had control over, to your point, if you had, you know, 3,000 employees, Now you have your 10 that you historically had. Now you have 3,000 other mini networks that you have zero control over because they're, you know, at people's houses who almost have no security on those. Their kids are downloading random, you know, games and apps on, you know, to their devices, and sometimes they're hopping on, you know, mom's or dad's, you know, work computer and hopping on the internet and playing some game, which then puts the virus on the computer. And they come back to work on the one day a month they come to check in on something, they plug in, and now that, you know, that virus or whatever could, you know, impact the network. And so from an IT perspective, that was like, it's pulling their hair out, hair's going gray, hair's falling out. You're out of control. It's chaos in an environment that's chaos in and of itself, and trying to figure out what this virus is doing. You're trying to run them at the same time and all these moving pieces. It was a nightmare. And so you hoped that your clients, you know, had insurance in the event something happened. But to your point, Doug, most didn't have enough in place for the true risk that they had from an environment perspective, because the information they were supposed to protect and be stewards of is out of their control and is kind of transferred to other people and not really thought of. I'm still responsible for that data, but now it's scattered across the US and, you know, and on someone's home network. And hackers knew that, right?
Well, we saw every one of our, we run investigative services, incident response services, and every one of the incidents we have investigated since the push from home last year in Ohio was what, mid-March. Every one of them was business email compromise on Microsoft 365, because in that rush to push into the cloud, to be as productive as we could be, organizations skipped that planning and securing process and stood up what they needed to just get stuff done.
Right.
You know, that caused problems last year. My concern, and I think you probably see some of this as well, is have those firms then circled back around. Because if I pushed quickly, I didn't harden the systems. I probably bought less than I need in terms of the Microsoft licensing. I'm in a hybrid network, which is a nice way of saying that Minecraft and Xbox and high school Zoom and college classes are all in that same environment. And sometimes the spouse is working too, and probably over consumer cable connections with no real protections on them. On top of that, a lot of the regulatory processes, things that people are obligated to do, went by the wayside because those were contained in processes that were built for the premises. And right. So we see that, you know, 12, 15 months later, some firms have not revisited that. And I would imagine you need to talk to your insurance company to say, hey, our environment's changed. So what you insured in February of 2020 is a different network operated and secured differently. And as a business, you need to look inwardly and say, how's my model changed? And is my new posture as secure as the old posture? And then am I testing it? Because a lot of that went by the wayside as well as the planning.
So no, you're right.
If somebody's made that move, they obviously need to speak to their cyber carrier if they haven't already. Are you seeing those conversations, or is it just a matter of those bubbling up as people renew?
It's probably more bubbling up as they renew. I think the underwriters are just as busy as the companies are, just trying to survive to some degree. But I think, you know, it's very rare, unless you're like adding a new vehicle or a new building or some employees, that, you know, businesses by and large are having that conversation with their carrier to say, hey, our environment has changed. I paid for this, but what do we do now, right? So that doesn't happen very often, just to be, you know, to be quite frank. What you should be doing, if you're not going to be doing that, which necessarily isn't standard practice, is with your changes, is your policy flexible with those changes that you have made, right? And so, for example, if you read in your policy that MFA is a requirement and you turn that off because of the work from home scenario and the COVID piece, then you could be at risk for, you know, your insurance carrier denying a claim if you were to have a cyber incident, or as a result of MFA not being on, right? So I think the more, you know, pressing issue is to focus on what's the requirements of your existing policy, and have I changed that's going to push me outside of those walls? And if I have, then you might want to call your broker to have a kind of no name conversation to kind of see what the carrier is doing in this space, because it's not just, you know, in the day where it was a one-off and one company was just kind of negligent, this is really less about negligence and more about a pandemic, and people are doing things to stay afloat. So it's really like, do you want me to be operational so I can pay my premium? Or do you, you know, you want me to focus on making sure that, you know, all of my systems are in place? Like, I have 24 hours in a day, and 23 of those is making sure my lights are on. So I'm left with 1 hour and I think I need to sleep. You know,
yeah, exactly.
It's that conundrum, right?
And then the insurance company, I can be 100% risk-free if I get rid of all of my insurance. That's not a very good plan either. So
yeah, exactly.
I see that.
Absolutely.
And then you mentioned MFA. We're hearing from insurance people, and that includes conversation you and I've had, that there's a push towards MFA being enabled before some of the carriers will cover somebody. We're seeing that as a trend because of some of what happened last year. Are you seeing other choices being forced on clients that drive that technology choice from the insurance perspective?
And that's probably the number one, what I'd say, because cyber insurance isn't really standardized. But that's the one thing that keeps coming up the most. It's a low-hanging fruit. It is somewhat simple, you know, in nature. Now there's a lot of pushback from the human side of actually wanting to abide by, you know, the MFA process. But in terms of implementing that from a technical perspective, it's relatively easy, and it can really, you know, minimize a lot of risk to a network or to an application, right? So it's low-hanging fruit from their standpoint. So we're seeing a lot of that. I mean, the other things that are popping up is contingent liability is often there, and business income replacement is also there. So what does your disaster, you know, your business continuity, you know, plan look like? What does your incident response plan look like? That's kind of like that next tier to understand, okay, we understand that even with MFA, something could still happen. Your employee could send out some information and it could happen, right? And so what is the downtime look like? How do you bounce back? How are you resilient in that process to continue on? And if we can be down for a day, because if there was an incident that happened and you can restore from backup and only lose, you know, a half a day's of work. And so the insurance company at that point in time is probably paying nothing, because you usually have a, you know, between a 24-hour and a 72-hour waiting period. So if you can keep it below that, then the insurance company is not paying anything at all. But if you get beyond that threshold, they want to see that you can be back up and operational as soon as possible, which then reduces the amount of the claim that would be, you know, would be filed. Because it's not just the business income. You know, you have the forensic stuff that comes into place. You have the notification. There's probably 10 to 15 different, you know, channels of payment streams that could be a part of a claim from a cyber, you know, incident. If we can scan those down, the more comfortable an underwriter is going to get from that space. And that's back to paying less for your insurance. If we have a stellar, you know, business continuity plan in place, disaster recovery, we test it on this frequency. It's, you know, we got redundancy. If you can like describe all these things to an underwriter, you should be paying less than someone who's doing none of that. Because in an event, they're going to pay more to them than they would to you. So you should pay less for that from an actuarial perspective.
Well, we've seen that. I started helping secure clients in the late 90s. And back then it was protective. Let's prevent it from happening.
Right.
And you could spend a lot of your time and energy to treasure on protecting it and really pretty much reduce your risk. And now if somebody wants to get into a business, they're going to get in. If they're highly motivated, they have the time and the energy, they're going to get in. And so those dollars that are spent solely on protective services that don't include how I detect when something bad happens, how I respond to it, really the difference between the firm that's more balanced with the PDR, the two-letter acronym, that is more balanced from the prevention, detection, response perspective is going to be more resilient. We're both sports guys. They're going to be able to take a punch and get back up off the floor and keep fighting in the ring, versus that firm that maybe just threw it all into all their treasure into the prevention side, and they don't know how to get back up, and they don't know how to quickly come back into production. It's miserable when one of those events happens, particularly a ransomware event, when you can't take care of your clients. And some of that is totally immeasurable in terms of the loss.
So right.
Point taken. And it's two choir boys singing each other because of what we see.
Right.
It's never going to go away, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And it's probably the only time that we will actually be singing in tune together. So we actually had to sing a song. I'm not sure how good that would sound, Doug, because I only sound good, you know, when I'm having a Holiday Inn Express moment, right? When I got the acoustics of the shower and the bathroom around me. Other than that, I'm horrible. My wife, plugs her ears.
It's like a TikTok moment. And probably go down as having the worst number of clicks ever, because I would agree.
Ever.
Terrible. Terrible. So we speak to resiliency and really from a cyber perspective. But one of the reasons we started this podcast was we saw up here in Columbus a lot of firms that were very resilient. You know, the restaurant industry is really taking it hard. But there's some restaurants that adopted to the takeout, adopted to the delivery services, have grown and thrived. We've seen manufacturing firms that re-engineered part of their production lines to make PPE. There's a favorite restaurant over here that it's a restaurant, but they're also a distillery, and they stopped making some of their liquor to make hand sanitizer. And you know, the stories go on and on. Your market perspective is a little bit broader than mine. We have an office in Cincinnati, but I don't get down there as often as you are. What did you see in that regard in Cincinnati? Our feeling was the business community, even though they were taking some shots last year through some of this unrest, actually stepped up and helped in a lot of different ways, and in some ways proved that they were resilient. Couldn't do that for every business because of what they made or what they did. But those did certainly have stories to tell. Favorite stories from the Cincinnati market, or maybe even something you've seen up here in Columbus that stands out?
You know, I think it was just as you mentioned, where we had those nuggets just about every city, right? Where folks didn't spend time, you know, saying, what about me? Why me? But how can I jump in this? Because, you know, in every, you know, tragedy of some sort or catastrophic event, somebody's making money as a result, you know, of that, right? If you have a you know, hurricane come through, while it devastates the real estate, somebody's getting paid to build that back up. Right. And so
Lawrence, if there's a hurricane, I've got a $75 sheet of plywood to sell you. Exactly.
Exactly. So there's that. Right. And so, you know, with PPE becoming really scarce, I know there were clients that, you know, make bedding type stuff or clothes, were able to quickly shift their production to make masks and other, you know, and other things. So I think it was folks who, and this is the word of the pandemic. Pivot, right? How many times have we heard the word pivot? If you were able to pivot in the pandemic to follow a class of business or an area of focus that there was, you know, a need, you could have done well. And that may have taken some, you know, planning, you know, beforehand, or just really smart people at your leadership group to see that. Let's not sit here and cry that we can't, you know, we can't make this anymore, but we can make this. I mean, people staying at home, you know, pool installers, that stuff went crazy, right? You know, outdoor patio furniture, although you couldn't find a contractor to do any of this stuff because everybody's at home and wanted to make their at-home life as great as it could be since we were all stuck at home. And to your point, you could sell a piece of plywood that was, you know, already warped and used at a premium for somebody who needed it bad enough, right? And that's just kind of the case. And so there's plenty of those stories. But I think for Cincinnati specifically, and even historically, Cincinnati is very well diversified. And when the rest of the nation has really big peaks, Cincinnati rises a little bit, but not at the same level. And then when other folks are going way down, we don't tend to go down as far. So we really kind of ride this middle wave. We still had really big projects of more than 500 new employees coming in and hundreds of millions of investment for new, you know, factories, you know, coming to the area. But again, I think we just kind of, we stay fairly level in the economy, whether it's an up or down. So I think I love that about Cincinnati. And I think where we are positioned with the airport and some other things gives us the ability to be, you know, pretty diversified as an overall, you know, economy. And we have college sports and professional sports. The only thing we're really missing is we don't have the hockey like you guys. Well, we have the, you know, the minor league hockey, but the professional hockey we don't have. We don't have professional, you know, basketball, but those are close by. But everything else we really have here, you know, in the, you know, in earshot, if you will, of our market. So I think, you know, in Columbus, I think Ohio was, you know, fared pretty well throughout the pandemic, well, just because of how we're positioned.
Yeah, at least these two cities, you talk about diversified, they're different. We have Ohio State, and then we have the state government, and you've got P&G, and everybody needs toilet paper and laundry detergent.
And right, and we have Kroger next to P&G, right?
So we both enjoy quite a bit of resiliency. And what we've seen here in Columbus is this explosion in some of the new tech firms, in insurance tech and fintech. This is becoming a hotbed there. So it's kind of crazy to think even in this COVID environment, we had We had a lot of startups that were dramatically successful and still good stories to tell. And I think that at the end of the day, that it's been a tough year, but business has served communities really well by continuing to provide jobs. And there's people, as we talked about earlier, that we need to weave into our market in a little bit better way. But business is good as long as we can keep taking care of people like you do in the nonprofit world and sharing ourselves after we've been successful.
And I'll say this, Doug, I think that didn't happen by accident, right? I think, you know, it wasn't by pure design, but I think the planning that, you know, both my background and some of the services of GBQ from an economic development perspective, that Ohio has done a phenomenal job, you know, really kind of across all industry sectors to diversify, you know, the state from a business perspective, but also they've been investing in technology and innovation for a long time. So I think when other states were struggling with that, we already had the infrastructure in place to really help incentivize and really push forward through this, you know, through this process of, what does innovation look like? We have money on deck to deploy. It's already in our budget for it. We have more takers coming into it with very, very unique things that are going to help us through the pandemic or things outside the pandemic. We had the framework in place, right? And so I'm not going to say I always agree with what government does, but I will say that with the various iterations of administration, keeping the eye on a balanced economy, you know, we have farmers to startups and, you know, in infant tech and you name it. We had that here in Ohio. I don't know how many times that we watch movies or other thing. Ohio or some city in Ohio can almost always be quoted in some movie that I watch or TV show. It happens so often because we are so diversified in so many different ways. I think, you know, Ohio is a great place for us to live and work in and to prosper.
Yeah, it's a great place to raise your kids. The school choices are tremendous. I mean, you think about, we can pick on each other's schools, but you put a list of 20 really top-notch colleges and you wouldn't have any arguments from 1 to 20 about who should be on the list.
Absolutely.
We're going to fight over who's which position, but we won't argue with them, but they all belong on the same list. And, you know, some of those
Absolutely.
Schools are producing technology that the, you know, to your point, and the only thing I would add is that we've done a good job of commercializing some of the work that those schools have done. And we've had a couple of clients that have commercialized technology out of Ohio State. And I know there's some of that going on down in Cincinnati. So anyway,
Absolutely. Good.
Innovation is good. And now I think we're seeing some of it. You know, people are starting businesses, but they're in the nonprofit realm. They're really trying to make a difference rather than make a profit. But they have the same passion that all of us have had as entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. 100% agree.
So some questions for you.
Yeah.
Close this out. Who inspires you?
You know, I mentioned my grandmother earlier in our conversation, and just as a young child, being able to spend time with her. She was an educator, so she was off in the summertime. So, you know, to spend those summers with my grandma, I didn't always like to go to Bible school and Bible study. You know, as a youngster, that you didn't really understand why you were doing that, but it really laid a great foundation, you know, for me to be, you know, a humble person and to give back to the community. And so she's the number one inspiration. You know, we lost her some years back, but, you know, I wake up every day, you know, thanking that I had a grandmother like her to really help guide me in what I do, you know, each and every day. So if you see my email signature, stay focused, right? And it says ML Greenfield. That's what that reference is for. So that's probably my number one inspiration.
So grandma said that to you in Bible class? Is it stay focused?
Well, you know, she gave great Christmas gifts, right? It was, you know, it was socks, neverware. It was pencils and a roll of pennies and maybe some children's, you know, Bible book. And inside that front cover, she would always, you know, write in there, you know, to whatever grandkid it was for. And you better believe at the bottom of that, it said, stay focused. And that's what she wrote. So no matter what it was, like, it was really kind of, you know, her thing. And the family still said this day, we said it while she was around. So it's we live and breathe it every single day.
Ready to go, grandma. That's cool. That's cool. Thanks for sharing that. What's your favorite life hack?
You know, lifetime hack, you know, I wouldn't say I'm a techie person, but, you know, life hack for me, I think I mentioned this earlier, is really just how to build relationships that matter, that they're genuine, right? And I think there's still so many people out here today that are too much focused on themselves and not about, we saw this during the pandemic, right? Where, you know, it's like to wear a mask, not to wear a mask, right? I don't want to wear a mask because I don't feel like I need to. It's not just about you, it's about other people, right? And so for me, I think that we've lost our way with that here, you know, in America about caring for your neighbor and caring for other people and just doing those things. So I know it's not super exciting about a life hack, but it's really back to the basics of caring for other people, doing for others as you would do for yourself, you know, but putting somebody else, you know, first. Now, let's say you don't care about you, but you know, it's not all about you. What do you do today that's going to impact somebody else and make their day, you know, a little bit better? You know, just saying hello to someone could take them from being in a depression to being, you know, having a great day. So when you walk down the street and you see someone, just smile or say hello. It's hard with a mask on, right? But they kind of raise up a little bit. You can still wave your hand, right?
I'm dealing with a smile deficit and a handshake deficit. So, and maybe a hug deficit too. But yeah.
Yes, agreed.
I can't wait till all that goes away. But I love that answer. What's been your most valuable failure?
You know, I think I take it back to my high school time. I was in a program called DECA. That program, you learned about business. There was competitions, I was in team management, and we went to nationals, and we went to state a couple of times. And I got fired from my job, Doug, in high school. And because I got fired from my job, I got an F in that class. And so, like, it rocked my world that, you know, I didn't do what I needed to do to communicate, you know, to my supervisor accordingly. And so once I was no longer employed, they had to call the school, and the school was like, oh, well, if you don't have your job, you get an F. So, you know, that really changed of, you know, productivity and responsible and accountability, you know, as an employee to show up to work, to do your job and do it to the best of your ability. So that failure there really helped, you know, guide me to today. So, you know, usually have perfect attendance. It's very rare that I miss anything. My schedule was packed. I don't like to miss a thing. That failure, you know, drove me, that F on my report card drove me to who I am today, for sure.
So F is for foundation.
Yes, that's right.
You work hard. How do you play to balance life out?
You know, it's a constant battle, but, you know, I try to play it with the seasons, right? I'm an avid motorcycle, no rider. And so when the sun is out and you can get out on the twos and be on the open road, I want to do that. So I really try to hunker down as much as I can, you know, during the winter time when you really can't get out. And balance of time is you're more watching movies and doing things inside the house with the family. But COVID kind of changed that whole landscape of what spring and summer really looked like. But just trying to make time and carve out time, whether that's the weekend or a couple nights a week, to just unplug and engage with things that aren't necessarily work, so you can have that step away to kind of recharge and reset. But, you know, take vacations, right? I know as a business owner, we can't always be 100% away from work, but I'm saying I'm only going to do work stuff when everybody else is asleep in the morning from 6:30 to 8 a.m. I will check emails and respond to stuff. And then after that point in time, I keep my phone, but I'm turning my emails off. My out of office is on. Don't look for me to respond to something unless it was pre-planned, you know, prior to vacations. I think that balance is necessary, but I hop on my motorcycle with one of the kids. I tell them, once you have a mustache growing in, you can't ride with me anymore. But my wife likes to ride, and my little one, he's only 10. He doesn't have a mustache yet. He calls himself a preenager, so he's still allowed to ride. And so he's waiting for me to get home tonight because the sun's out here in Cincinnati, that we can get out and ride this evening.
Last question. Life is touched by technology that we only dreamed about when we were kids. What did you dream about when you were thinking about what you were going to become when you were in middle school?
Well, I wanted to be a truck driver, Doug. I had this thing about being up high with this really big steering wheel and to turn the corners and all those gears to shift. And they were nice. Most of them were nice and shiny. And I still have that dream today. I'm not a truck driver yet. I don't have my CDL license. I will get them at some point. But I want to, in retirement, to be able to have one of those really nice semi-trucks with the bed and all the amenities on the inside, so that as I travel across the U.S., I can still make money by carrying a load.
Well, you're the first truck driver on the Empower Hour. That's a great story. Lawrence, thanks for joining. I knew we'd get into a bunch of nooks and crannies because you're just such a multi-flavored kind of guy in terms of the things that you do in life and like and enjoy. And so I appreciate your time. Like I said earlier, I Google Lawrence Jones and you're everywhere.
Thank you.
How do people connect with you online? We'll make sure that it's on the webpage, but I want you to say it as well.
Yeah, for BusinessWise, www.riskversity.com, RISKVERSSAMITY.com, or email lawrencejones@riskversity.com, so ljones@riskversity.com. I'm usually connected, happy to respond, connect with anybody who needs our services, or just wants to talk and connect in the community. Happy to do so.
And he's always on time and he is definitely a problem solver.
So. Yes, I am. Thank you so much, Doug, for having me. It's been a pleasure to be here on this podcast. And I look forward to working with you more in the future.
Time's up. Thanks for listening to this episode of Empower Hour. Join us next time by subscribing to Empower Hour on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or your preferred listening platform. Want more GBQ? We don't blame you. Visit us online at gbq.com for the business news and advice that matters most. Who is empowering your growth?